Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
Well, I've got to say, first off, welcome.
Okay, thanks for having me.
For everyone, I've got Dr. Stephen Furlich from Texas A&M Commerce right now, professor. You know, my wife was excited when she heard about this. She's like, good, maybe you'll learn something from his dialogue. But congrats. You know, I told you earlier, one, went to Texas A&M for my undergrad. I was a little older. I was an active duty Marine. And then my first job when I retired was actually the Texas A&M system with, is Chancellor Sharp still there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was a short stint. I think after 3 days, my wife then was my fiance. I called her and I said, hey, six months. And I already started looking for another job. So I commend you.
Thanks.
Commerce is where?
It's north of Dallas. It's used to be called East Texas State. So it's northeast, almost to Oklahoma.
That's okay. All right.
45 minutes north of Dallas.
Beautiful, beautiful area.
Yes. Love it up there. Green.
Yes. Which a lot of people don't equate when they think of Texas necessarily, but so you've gotten into the biological, influences on gender communication, which I think has just become so relevant given everything from, now you can select your gender, based off of, however you feel. But, also I don't want to say an attack on tradition. I call it the paradoxical sort of decline of masculinity. And what drew you to this this arena?
So to give a little background information about it is I've taught a gender communication class for the last 8 years. And one of the things that I kept coming across over and over was that there was some communication differences between males and females. And the research and communication and a lot of the other types of disciplines as well always tried to dismiss it as something to do with social learning, society, the way that you're brought up in your family, schools, all those types of things. But the bell that rung off in my head was, how can we keep seeing these same consistent communication differences between males and females from early on, childhood, throughout adulthood? It stays consistent. But yet, taking that step further, these are people coming from different backgrounds, different societies, different families. So if you have what's the same consistent type of variable within it, and that was biology that struck to me. So I looked for different books I could use for my class that helped explain the biological differences between males and females, and there wasn't any. Because you had decades of research coming that was out. Usually about the 1990s, Deborah Tannen comes to the top of my head, and she wrote a book in 1990 and pretty much said, yes, acknowledged there are some differences between males and females with the way they communicate, but 100% for the most part you can explain from society, the way you're brought up, we're brought up in two different cultures. So then I started to look at what are some biological explanations. So I looked at psychology, I looked at psychiatry, I looked at biology and neuroscience. And then from these other disciplines, I brought those ideas together to pinpoint brain structural differences and sex hormone differences that contribute to communication differences between males and females. And recently, there's been some in gender communication research that's been discredited. And that's in my chapter two of this book, where it's not as scientific as rigorous research that they're producing. So I went to other fields, other disciplines that may be a bit more objective.
And I love the title. It's a good title, okay. Sex Talk. Of course, naturally, people, it's going to catch your eye. Let me step back. So you went to Texas Tech.
Yes.
Got your bachelor's in philosophy. Was that correct?
No, it was psychology.
Psychology. Thank you.
And then my graduate degree in communication.
In communication. Yes. And then PhD in?
Communication as well, with emphasis in classroom communication. And then as I started doing more research as a junior faculty member at A&M mm-hmm. Commerce, mm-hmm. that's when I started doing more of the interpersonal type of communication research.
When you chose to start up that class, gender mm-hmm. communication, were you told to do that, or were you at liberty to create the class of your own volition?
When I came into that university, it was just me and another faculty member in communication, and he wanted to take more of the lower level types of courses. So mm-hmm. he said, create these five or six different courses. And something that's always been in the back of my mind was somewhat of a contradiction, I guess, to some degree, of we keep hearing all this research out here, but what you see for the facts doesn't necessarily support it as well.
So let's get into it.
Okay.
Because I'm interested in this more from a standpoint of, you know, I've talked about leaders, and the best leaders mm-hmm. I've met did not have one communication style. What I mean by that is they had the ability to match as best as possible the communication style of who they were interacting with, especially within the SEAL teams. You've got a range of personalities, mm-hmm. and it was almost like an art, a mastery. Mm-hmm. So from a perspective of all the leaders listening in on this one, even for, you know, husbands, yeah. and this is Men's Journal, predominantly a male demographic, let's educate them on the differences, not only for women, but for men. And what are those markers that you're seeing that, you know, cross cultural lines that have led to this book?
Okay. Just briefly to give a little background, the brain itself. So all communication starts in the brain. So you can't have communication without the brain. And now science has advanced far enough where you can analyze the human brain and with over 90% accuracy predict if it's male or female. So if all communication starts in the brain and you can predict if it's male or female with over 90% accuracy, you can see that there are structural differences between the male brain and the female brain. And it's also been identified in areas of communication itself.
So when you say that, you're saying if we take a woman and a man, uh-huh. split their heads open, there are structural differences to the brain.
Yes.
But I think you're also referring to how, you know, if somebody is formulating what they're going to say, certain parts of the brain are firing that are different between men and women.
Yes.
Is that accurate?
Yes.
And how do you, is that what, MRI scans, nodes, how are you?
FMRIs.
FMRIs?
Yeah, where it fires up a lot of times.
Yes.
So at conception, everyone pretty much starts off on the same track, mm-hmm. which we usually think of as female. So if you do nothing, you make a girl. And then after about 4 months after conception, that's when you have the Y chromosome starts to produce more of the male sex hormones, androgens, mm-hmm. that you mm-hmm. think of as testosterone. And that's what creates the brain structural differences from that after 4 months. And then it goes all the way up to age 30. So throughout your life, adult life, going into your adult life as well, these sex hormones, your brain, your human brain is very neuroplasticity. So it changes. And at that beginning developmental stage, that's when it creates those brain structural differences, those sex hormone differences after 4 months of age with the male sex hormones of the androgens, testosterone, and then the female is producing the estrogen.
Accurate to say the brain is not totally formulated until roughly 30 years of age.
Yes.
Wow. I mean, especially with the current argument going on about, you know, let's say transgender transitions mm-hmm. for 18-year-olds. Mm-hmm. It's amazing to think that there's still 12 years of development of the brain. And I know a lot of people are making the argument that, you know, 18-year-olds are really not in a position to make that decision at that that time, despite the law saying it.
And then after reading my book, you should be able to identify yourself pretty straightforward. What are five differences between the male brain and the female brain? And how does that contribute to communication differences in terms of your language differences, your perception, emotional differences, words that you use, interests that you have as well? And then with the communication language differences, you sort of touched on that. I could go into more detail about that.
Yeah, please.
So one of the things that's been found rather consistently for decades is that females from early on tend to be superior with, when it comes to nonverbal communication. So they understand other people, other people's nonverbal communication at a much more accurate level than what males do. There's been numerous studies done on it. They've even done it where you have like a curtain and two people put their arms through the curtain, you hold hands, and they can identify the other person's emotional state more accurately than what the male can. So during social interactions, there are actual biological reasons that explain why females are superior when it comes to nonverbal communication, empathizing with other people, understanding their behaviors. So, for example, and this is one of the things that I think science has already justified, and it's pretty much set in stone, that females have many more connections across both hemispheres with their brain. And then males have more connections within each hemisphere of the brain. So during a conversation with females, they can access different areas of the brain, engage in the conversation, while at the same time they can analyze your nonverbal communication, your nonverbal behaviors. Whereas with us males, we're much more compartmentalized with our connections within each hemisphere. Mm-hmm. So we could do one or the other, but asking us to do both at the same time, we're just not equipped for it. Also, they have more mirror neurons that are activated during social interactions. And what these mirror neurons do is they look at someone else's nonverbal behaviors, and then they prepare your body to display those same types of nonverbal behaviors that you see someone else do. And when you prepare your body to display those same nonverbal behaviors, then you feel, you take on that emotional state. You feel that same emotion as the other person because your body's prepared to do the same thing that the other person does as well. They even have, females even have higher levels of oxytocin, and this is a big contributor, during social interactions, that bonding chemical. So they feel more of a connection with the other person during the social interaction, and if you feel more of a bond with them, you're going to understand them more, and you're going to empathize with them more. And during social interactions, they have more of their overall brain that's activated. Whereas with males, when we communicate language-wise, the left side is activated more, and then with emotion, the right side. So as you can see, we're much more compartmentalized.
It's funny how you bring up the word empathy, because I mean that's sort of in as you're explaining a lot of this. I'm gonna go to the societal norms that we place on both men and women, that women are more empathetic in their communication. So that is why.
Yeah, it's been found for decades, you know, that they are more empathetic. They understand, they identify other people's emotions much more so than what males do. And then again, previous research, gender communication, in the English discipline, even communication itself, always try to explain it away with societal types of factors. But there's these biological, how can you argue with these biological factors?
As you're explaining this, Will, I'm thinking for professions, it's just so women are better negotiators, or they can be if they're picking up on nonverbal cues, better lawyers picking up on body language than most males.
In different roles, I would say, yes, they are superior because they can understand the other person much more so than what we're able to. So maybe picking a jury who's empathetic to your client or who isn't.
That's genius. Genius. If my wife was here, she'd be reinforcing all this, just shaking her head like, this is why. This is why.
And then conversational differences. There are some reasons for that as well. So with females themselves, it's been found early on, from an early age, that girls are superior with language, social abilities than what boys are. And boys are at a much higher rate diagnosed with language disorders and language disabilities. And there's different reasons for that. One is testosterone hinders language ability, and estrogen helps it. But then also with females themselves, they have larger areas in the brain, such as Brodmann's area 44 and 45. And that's responsible for verbal fluency, verbal memory, so that particular area. And they have a larger and more active hippocampus, and that's a major contributing factor. And the hippocampus plays a major role in memory, so they have a better conversational memory, episodic memory during conversations. Maybe your wife reminds you of things that was said that you probably don't remember nearly as well.
That misspelling, her general vocabulary is much higher than mine. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then also that they have more blood flow to different areas of the brain. They're responsible for emotion, creating words, connecting the words. And again, with males themselves, during the language or during social interactions, the left side is activated for language and the right side for emotion. So again, it's much more, the bottom line is, it's much more difficult for males to tie in the current conversation with emotion, two different sides are activated two different times, and past memories as well, because the hippocampus is responsible for that. So with females, when they engage in conversation, they could talk about the topic at hand. They could tie in emotion and past memories all together. And us males, we need to take into account that this makes sense to her, tying all these things together, and she's not personally attacking us or getting off track or just rambling, but that's what makes sense to her. And she needs to understand when we're engaged in a conversation, if we only say a few words or just address the topic itself, it doesn't mean that we're emotionally removed. It's just more difficult for us to do conversation and emotion at the same time and tie in the memory as well.
Oh, this is explaining so much. So I see next you have emotion. Is that?
Yes, on the bottom of my page. So one of the things that has been found for decades, I'm guessing, is that females are diagnosed at a much higher rate with depression than what males are. And again, it's in the communication research and research as well. It's usually tried to be explained that maybe they're more likely to go to the therapy. That's why they're higher depression. But there's biological reasons for that as well. This is something that shocked me when I was doing the research. I sort of had it in the back of my mind as a psychology major, but then it sort of made it more, much more concrete that the serotonin system, and serotonin is used to help balance emotions, balance moods, make you a bit happier, fight depression, things like that. It's been recognized now for over 40 years in science that the serotonin system is sexually dimorphic between males and females. That it's been identified that the way that it functions is differently between males and females and plays a major role in emotional regulation and things like that. So there's some research out there, and not nearly as much as maybe what there should be or could be, but that males themselves have higher levels and have more access to serotonin and higher levels in their brain than what females do. And that testosterone is even used to treat depression. And adult males have 20 times as much testosterone as what adult females do. So you can see that as being a contributing factor, because what testosterone does a lot of times is converted into serotonin, which helps to balance and regulate emotions and things like that. And there's even been some research out there that's traced anxiety and depression to the X chromosome. And with having two X chromosomes and another person having Y, you see all these pieces of the puzzle come together. And if you're still not convinced after that, I don't know why you wouldn't be. No, just kidding. That, taking it aside, not even consciously, when male and female are looking at subliminal negative faces, there's much more activation, brain activation for females when they see a negative subliminal face than what it is for males. So it's a much more social interaction or a much more emotional intense type of experience for females, even when they're not even aware of it. Looking at just a subliminal negative face, they're going to have much more activation in their brain in the emotional areas than what males are. So if you put all these pieces of the puzzle together, serotonin system differences, X chromosome for depression, anxiety, on a subconscious level, conversations and social interactions are much more intense for females. You can see why that they're more prone to it. And it's even been found that in major hormonal shifts in females.
Depression increases.
Yes, yes.
Okay. Have the stats on depression for men and women held pretty steady?
Yes.
Over the years, the decades?
Yes. Okay. Yes. It's always it's always consistent that females are diagnosed with depression much more
at a higher rate.
Yes.
But that's also due to the fact that they're more apt or willing to go seek help than men? Does that maybe contribute?
Why can't it be both? You know?
Yeah, true.
That maybe they are more likely to do it, perhaps, but maybe they are also experiencing it more as well, and that's why they're seeking it out much more so than what males are.
Let me ask you this. From your studies, I mean, your control groups must include young children all the way to grown adults. Is it?
Various studies at various ages. A lot of times they focus in on one demographics. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But what I try to do is synthesize together a bunch of different articles together with, and see these consistent themes.
Outside of the biological differences, what role does environment or society play into communication for men and women? And let me sort of nuance that. If I am a young boy who grows up in a house of, you know, the father's removed, a mom and my three sisters, does that impact the way I communicate? Do I evolve or I don't know if that's the right word. Do I start to assimilate with certain, again, biological differences in terms of how women communicate?
That's a good question. I always look at on a continuum, and you have a continuum with two different ends, not to be extreme, not to use hyperbole or over-exaggerate, but there are differences and is on this continuum, however large you want to make that continuum, with females on one side, males on the other side. You can move on that continuum closer or farther away from each other, but I haven't seen anything consistent research that's, you know, credible, scientific, that flips them, that has shown that there is an ability to flip with the male on average being more empathetic and a female, you can get in this if you want, with a better spatial ability. I've never seen that.
So, again, I don't want to make this, right now it's a hot topic, and it's not a good topic to hit, but with transgender, you know, with the transition, a man moves to identifying as a transgender female, you can still pick up the differences of whether it's a male or female based off the brain.
Yes, you can still pick up the brain differences. There's also a pretty reliable indicator, I would say. It's called a 2D4D ratio. Mm-hmm. And your finger that you point with versus your ring finger. That your ring finger, if that's longer than the finger that you point with, then you are exposed early on with higher levels of androgens, male sex hormones, testosterone, and then there's a bunch of associations with that. And then vice versa, if your finger that you point with, your index finger, is longer than what your ring finger is, then it's higher levels of estrogen. So how can you change that? And how can you change the brain structure? And
Will, are you slowly putting the hand out? Like, yeah.
So you look at the inside of your hand, your palm, mm-hmm. and you go by the ridges, and then you measure each one independently.
Okay. And if the index finger is longer,
then that's estrogen, and that's what females usually have. And if it's the ring finger, then that's male, and that's usually testosterone.
Okay. Yeah, I'm the listeners are going to probably be breaking out rulers here. Let me ask you this. Given the advent of identity politics and transgender politics, have you gotten any resistance on the campus?
Yes, to some degree. So this class I taught as an undergraduate class, mm-hmm. and then I also proposed it as a graduate class. And then there was, in the faculty meeting itself, there was disagreement with it, and I wasn't allowed to move forward with it as a graduate class.
That makes no sense to me. If you could teach it undergraduate level, mm-hmm. why couldn't you have a more engaging conversation at the graduate level?
That wouldn't make sense.
Interesting. I we'll come back to politics on the campus, and I don't want to make that the mainstay, but I am interested mm-hmm. from your perspective, and I don't want to put you in hot water either. Uh-huh. Just a sort of a subjective view of what's going on campuses, because I know that's a big concern. Uh-huh. But I you've got me intrigued more so than most guests. I'll let you rant. Just keep going.
So one of the things that I touched on just briefly was that there are social behavioral differences between males and females, and these have been found early on. And from an early age, boys do certain types of play behaviors are different from girls. And again, we've always been told for decades that's because that's the way that they're brought up. But this is what's been relatively new, and I think relatively reliable breakthrough. It's based on sex hormone levels. So prior to birth, sex hormone levels can predict certain types of language behavior, certain types of play behavior, other things as well. So higher levels of androgen or testosterone, the male typical sex hormone, has been associated with those male typical types of play behavior, such as the more aggressive, playing with the ball, the rough types of behavior. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. testosterone is also linked with better spatial ability. So you may be saying, well, males have higher levels of testosterone, and they do those types of play behaviors as well. So how can you know that's it? Well, there's a condition out there. The acronym is CAH, and there's roughly one in 10,000 girls who are born with this, and it's higher levels of androgens, male sex hormones. And what they found was that the girls who are born with the CAH have more typical types of play behavior associated with boys than what the average girl does. And it's even been found that they have better spatial ability, such as what boys do as well. So tracking objects, directions, hand and eye coordination. And they also found out with the girls that have these higher levels of the androgens that they're born with, that they tend to go in more male typical types of careers as well. So
what we call tomboys.
Yes.
Sometimes.
Yes.
You said 1 in 10,000.
Yes, are born with that. But you see the same consistency as the sex hormone and not necessarily the way that they're brought up.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that most people probably relate to, and it's used in comedy or whatever else, is directions. And males and females, men and women, driving in the same car, this, that, and the other. It's been consistently found that males are superior study after study with cardinal directions, north, south, east, and west, and that's highly related or highly linked with testosterone levels that help spatial ability, whereas estrogen actually hinders or hurts spatial ability.
You're kidding me.
No.
So the ability to simply say we're standing here, which way is north?
Yes.
I would think that's learned.
The ability to actually, okay, you could think of it this way. And this is a good point as well. With sex hormones, you can think of that as maybe like the oil in the engine, mm-hmm. and it helps it function. Mm-hmm. So if you have one type of oil in one engine and a different type of oil in another, it's going to help or hurt those particular areas for those particular functions differently.
So, you know, I've seen some women in the military that are great orienteers, I think.
Okay.
Especially pilots, okay. Where they can be like, nope, north, that way, south, uh-huh. southwest. Uh-huh. Is that something that can be overcome despite the biological differences where women...
You can improve to some degree, but mm-hmm. I venture to guess that probably most of them probably maybe have higher levels of testosterone than what the average woman does. Women. And then maybe I'll have your insight on this. So when you and your wife are talking about directions, driving, or whatever, if you use cardinal directions, she's comfortable with landmark. And women do just as well as what males do with landmark directions, where those physical types of things, a building, mm-hmm. a tree, mm-hmm. a pond, or whatever else, that's what they're comfortable with. And we could do both or the other, but the testosterone helps us, and estrogen actually hinders them with those cardinal directions.
Yeah, I'm not saying you're not wrong when it comes to my wife. Yeah, with cardinal directions, yeah. No. But she also never had a map and compass. Mm-hmm. You know, that was never her thing, but interesting. That's interesting.
One more thing with, we talked a little bit about conversational differences. And one of the things that I think that the bottom line is that we need to understand from the other person's perspective in terms of what's their abilities, where are they coming from. So there is a relatively well-founded type of phenomenon out there when it comes to gender communication differences. And probably most people can relate to seeing this play out in real life, such as with the Johnny Depp and Amber Heard, what was going on. And the title of this particular, well, title of my chapter and of this particular phenomenon is She Demands and He Withdraws. So there's a conflict dynamic that tends to go on in a lot of relationships where both people feel like they're not having their particular needs met, and it's for different types of reasons. So she demands more out of the relationship because he doesn't, for males, it's much more difficult for us to process emotional type of communication and relationships. We're just not as equipped to it because estrogen helps it, testosterone hinders it. And then also, as we already talked about from early on, we have inferior language abilities. So she's anticipating for him to self-disclose and to be emotionally available is what she is. He's going to disappoint her each time. And then she's going to feel like I'm emotionally invested in this relationship and he's not. So she's going to demand more from it. And he's going to feel that what he does is not being valued from her, because that's the way that he contributes to the relationship through doing certain types of actions as opposed to what he says language-wise. So there's a few things that, and that's what even came out in the Amber Heard and Johnny Depp trial is. She says every time there's a conflict that comes up, you just get up and leave, Johnny, and you just withdraw from the relationship, and that's what this is itself. And we saw how that turned out after the birthday party and this, that, and the other. She demanded more from him and showed her distrust.
I think we need dislike. To break down Jason Momoa's testimony. That was interesting in itself. That was comedic. What you're saying, though, it could not be more spot on. And, you know, we joke about these societal, you know, women engage, mm-hmm. men withdraw. It's true. Mm-hmm. I've heard my wife say it's sometimes you're emotionally unavailable. Mm-hmm. I mean, how often do we say that mm-hmm. to men say that to women, just in my experience alone?
And that could be for a number of reasons. It could be either because of language ability differences, or I even have a chapter in my book called The Man Trance. And because we're much more compartmentalized, we could focus in on one thing at a time. So if we're trying to relax or whatever, that's probably one of the last times that we want to start in on a deep conversation, that whatever it is that we're doing, that's what we want to focus in on. So if there's a conflict or something that needs to be brought up, the problem is for her, everything is much more connected. So her brain's much more interconnected. It's a much more intense emotional experience. So she needs to get rid of this much sooner than what he does. He's in the moment much more so. And during like the resting state, even his functional resting connectivity and brain activation is less than what hers is resting. Mm-hmm. Whereas with him, he could go back to it later, and she needs to resolve, or it just keeps building and building. So what the best thing probably to do is to say, this is a problem that we need to address. When do you want to do it and set up a time to do it? And speaking about conflict and that demand withdrawal, there's two things that could be done. One is they found out that touch prior to conflict, to your conflict conversation, maybe holding hands or whatever, that increases the oxytocin levels between both people. So that bonding chemical increases. So you empathize, understand the other person much more so. And then secondly, mimic behaviors. What mimic behaviors do is activate similar areas of the brain. So when you display the same types of nonverbal behaviors, and it also increases the oxytocin levels as well. So if you activate similar areas of the brain by doing the same nonverbal behaviors, you understand and take on the emotional state of the other person, and you empathize with them much more so.
I'm going to use that one next time. Touch. Interesting.
So maybe, and just throwing this out here, next time you go to some sort of social gathering, there's couples around, who's in a healthy relationship, who's not, look at their mimic behaviors. Who are mimicking positive behaviors of their partner is probably in a much more positive relationship. And those who are not in sync with each other, nonverbally with their behaviors, even maybe their blink rate, their breathing rate, or whatever else, maybe their relationship isn't going nearly as well. That could be with anything. That could be relationships. It could be friendships, coworkers, whatever else. How often does someone take on your nonverbal behaviors indicates how much they empathize and maybe like you? And then how much is it different or how much do you take on someone else's as well? So it's kind of a barometer of relationship quality, mimic behaviors.
And your first book was Nonverbal Epiphany, Steps to Improve Your Nonverbal Communication. Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. Having traveled the world in all your studies, does nonverbal communication cross societal and cultural barriers?
So one of the things that I think best explains it is that there's a lot of consistency in nonverbal behaviors, but then culture influences how we display those the variations to it. So everyone has different personal distance. Everybody knows about that based upon different cultures. And off the top of my head, I think it's like 16 centimeters or something to that, that if it violates 16 centimeters, the personal space of the other person, that's when it starts to get uncomfortable. So you have some flexibility with it. But then everyone, and this is consistent across all cultures, it's biological, universal, experiences the same, and there's different numbers, 5 to 7 basic emotions. So everyone, the happy, the fear, the contempt, sadness, 5 to 7 of them. But depending upon your culture, how are you going to display it? So everyone's going to experience it the same, but then it's going to alter to some degree in terms of if you're in an individualistic type of culture, then you're probably a bit more expressive in your nonverbal behaviors. Whereas if you're in a more collectivistic culture, maybe the Far East or whatever, then you're a bit more reserved with your emotional because that's the culture itself, but you're still experiencing the same emotion.
Yeah, that makes sense. How about regionally within the United States? Have you seen differences in nonverbal communication versus somebody, let's say on the West Coast, Seattle, versus somebody in the Northeast?
Yeah, with the Northeast, I've experienced a number of them. My dad's friend is from the Northeast. We have a person at the university from the Northeast, and the vocal tone's much louder. The personal space a lot of times is much closer, and there tends to be a lot more animation and gestures and things like that as well. So everyone does it, but there's a slight... how much it varies based upon culture itself, even within the U.S., probably even within Texas as well.
Yes.
West Texas from maybe East or South or Dallas from West Texas is probably vastly different as well.
How funny. You just basically described the first one as like a New Yorker or somebody from New Jersey is what we always typically thought, you know, in California.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So a few other things that... My favorite chapter of the book, and this sort of ties into it, what we've been talking about is it's chapter 12, Women's Sixth Sense. And it's been found consistently throughout research that women are superior in all five senses, and it gives them some sort of magical powers, mind read. So they're better with touch, more sensitive to it, taste, more sensitive to it, smell, more sensitive to it. Estrogen is highly correlated with hearing ability, so they could hear a wider range of sounds as their estrogen are at higher levels. And then when menopause kicks in, then their hearing ability starts to decrease as well. And then sight is one thing that I find very interesting, that color vision is on the X chromosome. So that's why you see much more so probably all males or all people who are colorblind are usually males because the color vision is on the X chromosome. So if you have two X chromosomes, that helps to overcompensate that. So women can see a much wider and a much greater spectrum of different colors, different shades, and they can communicate that because they have a better vocabulary with colors as well. And then they have more P cells in the retina as well. And the P cells are used for color and detail. Mm-hmm. So they could pick up on color changes in people's faces and detail subtle types of changes in people's faces as well. That gives them an ability to empathize much better. And they have a larger, more active insula. And what that is a part of the brain that takes in the sensory information itself. So I'm looking at maybe your nonverbal behaviors, maybe the changes in your colors in your face, maybe even some subconscious smells as well. And then I process all that to make sense of what's this other person's emotional state, what's their intention. So this probably came about from biologically, from our ancestors, where the woman stayed back at the cave and raised the baby. Mm-hmm. And the woman that didn't have very good nonverbal understanding of the baby, their genetics didn't pass on because their baby didn't survive because they didn't know what the baby needed. Was it hungry? Was it sick? Was it sad? And then what we already talked about with males having a superior spatial ability and cardinal directions, the male went outside the cave, ran around, chased around all these different things to bring back the resources back to the cave. And if they ran around and couldn't find their way back, their genetics didn't get passed on. Those who had the superior spatial ability, theirs did.
Break this down into scenarios for me, women versus men.
Okay.
Women are more equipped to do this, sort of the pros of what makes them better communicators in contrast to men and vice versa.
Okay, so for women, empathy, they can empathize and understand people much much better. And where we talked about the biological reasons why, having a better ability through the different senses, mirror neurons, and the relationship itself, it's much more intense, increasing their oxytocin level to them, and it's a much more intense experience. So they empathize better with other people, and they have a better equipped system to express themselves through language than what males do as well. So they can tie in more details and emotion and past experience much better. And for males, we tend to be a bit better when it comes to spatial ability, where we talked about. object rotation, hand-eye coordination. Mm-hmm. So that's a big thing in sports, and the transgender issue with that as well. And we tend to be a bit more focused as well because we're much more compartmentalized. So stay on one particular task and not letting these other things bleed over as well.
How come men are, again, I was about to put out a blanket statement when I can't walk back. Why does it seem that men are better storytellers? I'm just trying to think of who in the public I see, and it's usually traditionally men that are sort of the storytellers. Does that come down to a biological difference?
I would guess maybe that it's a bit more concise with the story mm-hmm. itself and not as much going in a different direction, so maybe it's easier to follow. That would just okay. be my guess.
I'm thinking comedy. Usually, I guess, uh-huh. Most of the people I follow are male comedians, uh-huh. and they deliver. But from everything you're describing, it sounds like women really are at an advantage when it comes to communication, both nonverbal and verbal.
I would say, and this is sort of my opinion, but it's all backed up with research as well, mm-hmm. that they're superior social creatures, and there's just no way around it.
That's also that motherly nature. I mean, even in our mm-hmm. household, it was, you know, dad was the disciplinarian. Uh-huh. Mom was the, what we called our emotional rock. Absolutely. I mean, she was our foundation in a lot of ways.
And yeah. She probably identified and brought up issues that the father was not even aware of. You know, what's wrong with little Johnny or whatever going on? And he's like, I didn't notice anything.
And just, yeah, and better dealing with it uh-huh. to strike a common ground with the person and empathize.
And they're much better just walking into a room of people and getting a sense of the room and the emotional state of the room and the emotional state of each person as well. Whereas we're much better to find that exit. There's an exit. There's a threat.
Yeah. I can empathize with that. How about the dynamics of a group or a tribe? When men get around other men, it seems like the communication style changes. Mm-hmm. Is that because, again, they're biologically they understand that there's more commonality now?
I would think so. So they just probably try to communicate more effectively to what their audience is, mm-hmm. and that's what their natural ability is, and they don't have to veer off. So they just do whatever comes naturally to them. And communication has been identified for decades. It's called report talk. And what males do is we just report what's going on and don't nearly instill as much of the emotion and the background memories to it in the relationship as well. Whereas women do much more of the rapport talk and building the rapport, mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. relationship with other people as well.
Yeah, I don't know how often I pretty often say, hey, beginning, middle, end, get to the point, dude, is when talking with men. Of course, I've never say that to my wife.
One of the things that has been found out there and is relatively interesting, I think, is pregnancy and the different dynamics that go along with that as well. So it's not a lot of studies out there, but there's a few, and because it's just so difficult for various reasons and it's costly, whatever. But first-time mothers, when they're pregnant, their brain volume actually decreases by up to 8%. And what that is, it changes. So their brain actually physically changes to better accommodate the baby within them and understand what the needs are within the baby. And they measured again up to 2 years later and found out that it didn't go back to what their size was prior to the pregnancy itself, that it still decreased up to 8% of what their brain was prior to the pregnancy itself. So what it does, it helps to bring together and unify the baby and the mother on the same type of understanding between them.
So the volume of the brain decreases.
Yes, during the pregnancy.
With the intent of
Changing to understand what does the baby need, how can I understand the communication of the baby much better?
And it does not regain that volume post-pregnancy.
As what they measured up to 2 years later, it still stayed the same. So maybe if it's 10 years later or 15, we don't know because it hasn't been studied that, but up to 2 years, highly unlikely.
How about second, third, fourth pregnancies?
They haven't
we've gotten there yet.
Yeah, I haven't seen any research that's looked at those, but what they found with the first time mother. So if you have third or fourth pregnancy, you're a first time mother to begin with, and you went through that brain change, and your brain probably hasn't changed, at least after several years. So it's always changing. And that's what men need to understand is during the pregnancy process, as she's going through these different changes, not just hormonally, but brain functionally as well. And her focus is more on the baby itself. And she's not going to be able to spend as much attention and as much energy on you and the relationship as what she did before the pregnancy. So don't have some sort of animosity. Why is she ignoring me? Well, that's what she's biologically trained to do, is to focus much more so on the baby within her.
Does that 8% volume reduction lead to a degradation of other skills prior to the pregnancy in terms of communication and brain?
I would say probably. That it takes away from certain types of things because you're moving it towards more of the baby. But again, there's not enough research out there to be as precise as what I would like.
That's fascinating. It's we often lose sight as men of what women go through to bear children. I would never wish that on anyone. It's, I mean, that is, to watch your body change like that and knowing that your brain reduces in volume 8%, that's in the my hat's off to the women of the world.
And if she's pregnant with a male, then her testosterone levels change and increase themselves for her, having a male. So it's what I've heard, it's much more difficult for a mother to be pregnant with a male than it is for a female.
And does testosterone lower post-pregnancy?
Eventually.
Eventually.
One of the things also, just to throw this out here, there's different debates out there, hot topic issues, that there was a study done and had pregnant women. And they shine three dots on the woman's belly. And if there were random three dots, the baby did nothing. If there were three dots that looked like two eyes and a mouth and resembled a face, the baby actually turned to look at those three dots that were the lights on the woman's belly. So it's indicating that there is some sort of cognition and awareness and mental ability of fetuses prior to birth that they can understand to some degree, and they have that natural need for connection with other people and relationships as well.
That's amazing.
So it's not just a lump of cells. It's not just something that's there that's not a human. You have these cognitions going on within if you can actually differentiate what looks like a face and what doesn't.
At what stage of the pregnancy, how many weeks in, did that start to become a repetitive pattern?
I'm not sure off the top of my head.
Off the top.
Yeah. But it is cited in my book. So if anybody wants to look at that reference and go to the
it's got
that,
the data.
Yeah,
absolutely. Oh, having written books, people will be like, on page 18, I'm like, I don't know what's on page 18. I forgot. Read it to me. Wow.
Something else that's interesting to me and something that you sort of brought up
is
what's going on when we change sex hormone levels artificially. And one of the things that's been around for a while is epigenetics. And the experiences that we do today influences how our DNA is expressed at conception. And it's up to maybe 3 or 4 months prior to conception. What we do today, our experiences, maybe our diet, exercise, or whatever else, sex hormone changes, can influence when we pass our DNA at conception 3 or 4 months later, how that DNA is expressed in that offspring later on, such as maybe obesity, other types of evolutionary effects as that as well. So we don't know what some of these long-term effects are of changing sex hormone levels artificially and what that does to DNA expression and what's that going to do to our population DNA genetic pool itself. It's too early, so we all know.
So you're talking testosterone replacement therapy, again, transgender, reducing reducing testosterone, increasing estrogen. We just, the studies have not been around long enough to determine the ultimate effects on one generation, two generations.
Yes. And what's that going to do? I mean, if simple things as a diet.
Let me ask you this.
Yes.
Is there a general belief of what it's going to do?
There has been some findings such as artificially increasing testosterone levels going from female to male to much higher levels. It's actually been found to decrease gray matter in the Broca's area of the brain, and that's responsible for language ability. And then it's also been found to, if you artificially decrease testosterone levels to a large degree, and sometimes it's necessary if some male's going through prostate cancer or whatever mm-hmm. else, so mm-hmm. you drop the testosterone levels a lot, that hinders spatial ability. So some of the same things that we see naturally occurring just gets exacerbated. So we already talked about how females are superior with language ability and the Broca's area, and we talked about how testosterone hinders language ability. Well, you see that play out with this transition from female to male, increasing the testosterone levels to high degrees artificially actually decreases the gray matter in the Broca's area of the brain that's responsible for language itself. So it gives us insight into why maybe males are inferior language-wise due to testosterone.
How quickly does your class, what's the right word, get filled up?
At the beginning, they go into it with a bit naive. They mm-hmm. think it's just another gender class, and we're just going to look at social issues. But then once they start to see that there's biological reasons for it, that's when they really spark their interest.
No kidding. But what I'm saying is people, your class probably fills up. People, pretty quick.
Yeah.
There's got to be some pretty engaging conversations with those kids.
There is, but a lot of it seems like an epiphany. That they recognize, oh, this is some of the problems in my relationships, or this is some of the reasons why. Like some of the girls in the class, mm-hmm. they really bring out, oh, now I need to understand why I can't expect him to be as emotional expressive because he doesn't have the language ability as what I do. And I need to understand that I can't just, as soon as he walks through the door, bring up conflict or different types of topics because we're much more compartmentalized, that we need to set time aside.
Like many things, if you educate yourself on the biological differences to gender communication, do you find that people are more apt or let's say armed to recognize, hey, I'm doing this right now. I understand why I need to stop and focus on, again, my partner? And
I think both. Not necessarily, I mean, your own abilities, but mm-hmm. then it just puts a light on your head when you recognize this in someone else, and it gives a rationale, a reason why this other person is communicating differently from me. So for women, they understand that the male is not necessarily uninterested in the relationship or emotionally removed. It's just language is on the left activated, emotions activated on the right, and ask us to do both at the same time. We can't do it as what she can. And us males need to understand they're not personally attacking us or getting off course when they bring in all these things together at the same time, language, emotion, memory.
This has been a 60-minute conversation, and you've armed me. Because everything you've described, and I know Will, just chime in. I mean, when I get home, I do compartmentalize. Mm-hmm. And actually, I prefer silence. There's times where she wants to engage, and I'm just emotionally turned off. So that is... Now, as you describe it, I recognize what I'm doing now. It just, I thought that was just my personality. And
no, we're all like that.
Yeah.
One last thing, just to touch on if we have time.
No, okay. We got time.
So intimacy.
Yes.
And with men's issues, this, that, and the other, that men think about sex much more so than what females do.
Is that true?
Yes.
What's the ratio? Is there a ratio?
You could find it, but throughout an ordinary day, it's like times, multiple times, much more so that men think about sex or intimacy or whatever you want to call it, much more so than what females do. And it's much more neurological, brain-activated reward and sensation for males looking at visual stimuli or engaging or whatever else it is for females. And that testosterone for males plays a large role in it. So if there's a low interest, sex drive, this, there, and the other, probably because it's low testosterone levels, and diet can help increase it, eating certain things, and then mm-hmm. exercise as well. But then what needs to be understood is it's much more complicated for females, and there's sexual interest and intimacy, this, that, and the other. So throughout a normal monthly cycle for her, as she gets closer to mm-hmm. evolution, her estrogen starts to increase. And when her estrogen increases, her sexual interest increases as well. So she focuses in on, when her estrogen increases, more intimacy. And then as her estrogen starts to decrease throughout the month,
When she's in that is when she's ovulating.
Yeah, estrogen is increased. Yes, and then post-ovulation.
Post-ovulation. Yes.
And it starts to decrease. Then she focuses in on calorie intake and food intake. So it's either one or the other. High estrogen, more of the sex and intimacy. Low estrogen, more food and calorie intake. So you can see how that's our biological needs to reproduce and to survive. And that kicks in with her within the month. That's relatively observable at times.
I've never heard of that before. That's...
And then also what we need to understand as males is that it's a much more complicated system for her to be ready for intimacy itself, that everything is much more overlapping and connected for her. So if there's stress, if there's anxiety, if she's not comfortable with the relationship or the other person, all those can affect her not feeling as ready for the intimacy itself. As opposed to what males are, which are much more ready at the drop of a hat and much more easily as
so, again, not trying to be humorous. Mm-hmm. It's so foreplay is a method of preparing her.
Yes, exactly. It does much more for her than it does for him. And as we already talked about, that touch increases oxytocin level. Mm-hmm. And what that does, it reduces her stress and anxiety as well. It makes her feel much more comfortable with the partner as well.
And as it goes back to chapter 12, where you said they have a much higher sensitivity with regards to touch.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
They even found that, and this indicates, and you've probably seen evidence of this, that women, that they get much more interested or aroused in maybe a movie or a romance novel, the more that they can't identify with the character themselves. Mm-hmm. So it's that relationship component that plays a major part in it. If they don't identify with the character itself, then there's not much going on.
This is good stuff.
One last thing on that. Mm-hmm. It's such prevalent in society. Probably everyone knows at least one person where later years, after years of marriage, filed for divorce. And over the majority of times that if a person files for divorce over age 50, it's the woman.
I have heard that.
And what's going on with that? Menopause kicks in mid-40s, late 40s, mm-hmm. early 50s, mm-hmm. major hormonal shifts. Estrogen drops. Estrogen really helps with relationships, relationship interests, relationship communication, intimacy, all those types of things. So for her, usually the optimum level of estrogen is like an inverted U, where it's not too high, not too low. And there's different frames of thoughts out there. I sort of have an opinion on this. So testosterone, the sex drive for males, and then it's been found in studies with extremely high artificial levels of testosterone introduced to females that that increases their sex drive. But it has been found that with all female mammals, across all mammals, estrogen helps to increase the sex drive of females. So it may not necessarily be the testosterone itself that increases the sex drive for females, but maybe it's when the testosterone is converted to estrogen mm-hmm. that increases the sex drive for the female themselves.
So the layman's explanation behind women after 50 or post-menopause filing mm-hmm. for divorce is yes. that there no longer is that connection that they have sustained, women have sustained with men.
I think so.
And so, okay, you remove that component and there's no longer a strong bond
yes.
between the two.
Estrogen drops and all these side effects of estrogen mm-hmm. dropping leads to it as well. And then, you know, it just increases the conflict. And then if you have the demand withdrawal at the same time,
yeah.
conflict
dynamic. It's the double whammy. Because it seems like the empty nester mm-hmm. divorces are becoming mm-hmm. all too common.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So her estrogen drops. Her need for offspring, you know, being in tune with that drops. The relationship value maybe drops as well because estrogen's related to that as mm-hmm. well. So it's a whole chain effect.
That's a bit frightening. Okay. So I've got my work cut out for me. Keep her happy. Wow. Man, this has been educational. Any other points you think for the men that are listening? This is going to turn into a great article. I can tell you that.
Let me see if there's, I don't know, but this is somewhat, if you want to introduce some humor, you could, but it won't offend me.
Yeah.
Cool. So biologically.
We'll end with humor.
We have two different types of mind frames out there, perhaps. So just starting out, that women tend to sniff out their mates. So there's those chemo signals where we all give off our own body odors.
Yes.
And they sniff out the genetic code of the other person. They want something that's different, that's genetically different. In case you have these ill types of genetics within you, they're usually recessive traits. So you don't want two people with similar recessive traits. So maybe with cologne, this or the other, maybe that has something to do with it. But females are pretty much always 100% certain of their offspring. And males are not always 100% certain that who they're raising, who their woman is pregnant with, is their offspring. And there's been numerous studies done with birds. And there's a certain percentage of male birds in a nest raising an offspring that's not theirs. So you can see why males tend to be a bit more particular with females, how many, you know, past history, this, that, and the other. Mm-hmm. And females are more interested in what's this person's potential for resource and protection ability. So I think there's some sort of biological innate to that.
That's accurate from what I've seen. My experience.
So I don't think it's a double standard, is what I'm saying. I think there's biological reasons for it.
Yeah.
They're always 100% sure that's their offspring in them or not.
That's a scary notion for most men and most fathers. I don't even want to contemplate that. But yeah, it holds true.
And I think, you know, maybe biologically over time, whatever, it's just gotten built upon too much. This, that, in other words, unrealistic, this, that, and the other, you know, from 10 years ago, what were you doing, this, that, and the other? And maybe it just something went haywire biologically, evolutionary within us that's not realistically within what's the last year or, you know, availability of pregnancy or this, that, and the other.
Well, you know, Dr. Furlich, I can't thank you enough for coming. I understand why this is a semester long class. I'll put it to you that way. Go check out his book, Sex Talk, How Biological Sex Influences Gender Communication Differences Throughout Life Stages. Probably mandatory reading for all men and all women, let's be honest. But, you know, additionally, his first book was about nonverbal communication, which is a tool that you want to sharpen for life because it preps you for any conversation or where to steer the conversation based off the person you're communicating with and how they're feeling. And again, I've seen leaders do it so well. They can pick up on those cues and match people's styles to make them more comfortable and disarm them in a lot of ways.
One of the things with your military background, in the nonverbal book, I have a whole chapter on deception and how you could pick up on different cues if someone's being deceptive and the biological things that you just can't fake.
That's key right there. That is, especially within the context, and you prepped it for the military, dealing with other cultures, is this person being deceptive or they tell me the truth?
One of the easiest things to do is just go on Amazon and then just type in my last name in the books category, Furlich, F-U-R-L-I-C-H, and then pops up pretty easy.
And we'll drop the links as well. Again, this is going to be one hell of an article, almost Sex Talk 101 for men. Again, thank you for making the drive down from Commerce. Do you have a personal website?
No, but my email, if anybody wants to send me a personal email, I invite it. I like hearing.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that I get most gratifying is when people tell me, yes, I read this, and they can personally identify with it and see it in their own lives. So just my first name, STEPHEN, period, FURLICH, at TAMUC.edu.
And we'll drop that in the article as well. And I got to agree with you. The greatest impact are the emails you get saying thank you. It was so educational. You impacted my life. Do you have anyone that reaches out and says, hey, can I audit your class? Can I sit in your class even though they're not students?
I haven't had that yet.
No? No. Okay. Well, after this, hopefully we can at least throw a few people your way. Again, thanks for coming and to the audience. This one was educational and a little bit eye-opening. And some things were probably a little tough to swallow. All right, guys. We'll see you next time.
Kelly Clarkson here to let y'all know that it's the holidays at Wayfair. No matter your space, style, or budget, shop Wayfair.com to get your home holiday ready.
Wayfair, every style, every home. Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.